Well, we haven't sung it this morning, but we do sometimes sing, "You're my friend and you are my brother, even though you are a king." It's quite something, that, isn't it, to stand in here on a Sunday and address the Lord of glory, Christ, the eternal Son of God, and say to him, "You are my brother." Is it appropriate to do so? Was there a slip in editorial standards when Christian Hymns was being compiled that enabled them to include in the book a hymn containing those words? Or are there legitimate grounds for uttering that line, "You are my brother"? Well, I want you to be clear this morning that there are legitimate grounds. The theology contained in that line of the hymn is impeccable. And if you're a Christian this morning, then you have the Son of God as your brother. He isn't only your brother, of course, as I emphasized 2 weeks ago. He's your Lord. He's your master. In fact, he relates to you in various different ways. But he is your brother. And it's that I want us to consider then for a few minutes this morning. Christ, our brother. And there are three things in particular that I want to say. And first of all, then, he's a proper brother. He's a proper brother. A year or two ago, we were in the village of Ullapool in the northwest of Scotland, and Hannah was picking up some fish and chips while the rest of us remained in the car. And she came back with the food, jumped in the car, and told us excitedly, "I've just seen a guy. I've never set eyes on him before, but I'm sure he has to be William Cumming's brother." She promptly messaged William, and William got back confirming that his brother was indeed passing through Ullapool that day. But of course, siblings are not always as recognizable as that. I mentioned at the carol service Jeremy Vine and his prominent TV role every election night. Well, if you were to watch him in that role, explaining to viewers the almost incomprehensible complexities of our British electoral system, and then the next day you were to turn on the radio and hear Tim Vine throwing out puns in one of his comedy programs, you might well incorrectly conclude that these two men just coincidentally share the same surname. Siblings can be very different. They can look different, they can sound different, they can have different characters and temperaments, so that no one would ever guess the relationship that exists. However, there is a limit, isn't there, to the difference that's possible. Siblings, in order to be siblings, do have to be the same kind of being. In other words, Jeremy Vine can have a brother with a very different set of gifts from his own, and whom you could never imagine being part of the BBC's election coverage, and that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But Jeremy Vine can't have a brother who's a doorpost, or a fighter jet, or a polar bear. That doesn't work. Siblings have to be the same kind of being. And it's precisely in this area that you seem to hit a problem when you're reading the book of Hebrews. And you get to chapter 2, verse 10. And in chapter 2, verse 10, the writer drops in this extraordinary little word to describe believers. He writes, "It was fitting that he for whom and by whom all things exist, in bringing many sons to glory." The he there is God at the start of the verse. And so he's describing believers there as sons of God. He needs to explain how that can be possible. And so in verse 11, he begins with the word "for." He's going to explain now. The S word that he's just used, sons, how can it be that believers are sons of God? He's going to explain here in verse 11, and this is what he says. He says, "He who sanctifies," that's Christ. We don't need to bother this morning with why he uses the language of sanctification here. All we need to know is that that's Christ. "He who sanctifies and those who are sanctified all have one source." Now you'll see from your footnote in the ESV, it's literally in the Greek, all are of one. And I think the NIV captures exactly what the writer's saying when he says, "are of the same family." He who sanctifies and those who are sanctified are of the same family. It's that great New Testament concept of adoption that many of you will be familiar with, the way in which at conversion God doesn't just coldly make a legal declaration about us, not guilty. No, he pulls us closer than that. He, as it were, brings us into his home and brings us there to take our place there alongside his eternal Son. Like him, members now of God's family. Like him, sons and daughters now of the living God. But this is the thing. In the abstract, as a bare theological proposition, that may sound reasonable enough. Set in the middle of Hebrews chapter 2, however, it sounds anything but reasonable, because at the risk of stating the obvious, Hebrews chapter 2 follows Hebrews chapter 1. And what's Hebrews chapter 1 about? Well, Hebrews 1, as you'll know, is an intense, breathless, spine-tingling exposure of the greatness of Christ, the Son of God. And we're not merely talking about angelic greatness here. The writer is at pains to be clear on this point. We're talking about divine greatness. We're talking about a person who is the radiance of the glory of God, chapter 1, verse 3. We're talking about a person whom angels worship, chapter 1, verse 6. About a person who may be addressed quite simply as God, chapter 1, verse 8. That's how supremely and incomparably great Christ the Son of God is. And now we're being told in chapter 2, verse 11, that in adoption we have taken our place alongside him in God's family. We're his siblings. Surely that can't work. Surely it falls foul of that principle I set forth a moment ago, that siblings have to be the same kind of being. Surely that person unveiled in chapter 1 is not the same kind of being as us. Surely the disparity, the asymmetry, the sheer gulf involved here means we cannot really be siblings. Surely he cannot be a proper brother. Well, that's why Hebrews 2 doesn't stop at verse 11. It carries on. And in verse 14, we're told something momentous. We're told there that Christ has done something to bridge that gulf which I described just now. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things. Christ partook of, shared in, if you prefer, flesh and blood. What's that talking about? Well, it's talking about what happened in the womb of the Virgin Mary. It's talking about the incarnation. And notice, it isn't a grudging, heavily qualified concession that Christ, in some minimal sense, assumed human nature. That's not what verse 14 is it? Not some grudging concession that Christ, in some sense, to some degree, assumed human nature. No, verse 14, it's brazen, it's emphatic, it's full on. I mean, that phrase, flesh and blood. In the New Testament, flesh and blood isn't merely a description of the human constitution. It's a fairly negative one. Our frailty and mortality are to the fore when we're described as flesh and blood. The other three occurrences all have a distinctly dismissive tone to them. In Matthew 16, verse 17, Peter has just taken that giant leap forward in his understanding of who Jesus is. You are the Christ, the Son of the living God. And what's Jesus' response? Flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, Peter. In 1 Corinthians 15, 50, Paul states, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God. And then in Ephesians 6, 12, he writes, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. And the implication is, if we did merely wrestle against flesh and blood, then the Christian life would be an absolute doddle. And Hebrews 2:14 then is clear that it's not some kind of specially modified humanity which Christ in the incarnation shares in. It's flesh and blood humanity. Humanity with all its characteristic limitations and vulnerabilities and incapacities. Moreover, verse 17 prevents us from thinking about this in too narrowly a physical way. Flesh and blood could suggest to us that Christ took only a human body. But no, verse 17 insists. He was made like us in every respect. In every respects. He assumed a human mind. He assumed human emotions. He assumed a human state of dependence. He assumed a human way of relating to God. He lived in an entirely human environment like us in every respect, verse 17 says. Indeed, I think verse 17 is a deliberate counterpart to chapter 1, verse 3. Together, the two verses are saying that Christ relates to God and he relates to man in the same way. In both cases, it's a relationship of total identity. How does he relate to God? He's the exact imprint of his nature, chapter 1, verse 3. How does he relate to man? He's like him in every respect, chapter 2, verse 17. In other words, he is as identical to us in his humanity as he is to the Father in his deity. If we must unstintingly ascribe to him all the glory and prerogatives of Godhood, because he's the exact imprint of God's nature, then we must as unstintingly ascribe to him all the weakness and indignities of manhood, because he's like man in every respect. And you see then the point that verses 14 and 17 are making. Christ is a proper brother. He's a proper brother. You know, the photo that has been causing so much controversy of Boris Johnson and various members of his cabinet in the garden at Downing Street. And many people have basically been saying that when a work meeting involves lounging around in the sun at tables laden with wine and cheese, then the term work meeting is being stretched to the point of meaninglessness. And if that magnificently transcendent person of Hebrews 1 is our brother, are we not stretching the term brother to the point of meaninglessness? He's such a different kind of being. No, Hebrews 2 is saying. He's not. Originally, yes. Eternally, yes. But now, now he fully shares our flesh and blood humanity. He is a proper brother. Secondly, he's a proud brother. He's a proud brother. Throughout the letter to the Hebrews, the writer is continually expounding the Old Testament scriptures. And this idea then in chapter 2 of Christ as our brother, he's getting that from the Old Testament, especially from Psalm 22, verse 22. We probably think of Psalm 22 being about Christ's sufferings, and certainly it is about Christ's sufferings, but not exclusively. It's the first two-thirds of the psalm which major on that theme. Halfway through verse 21, however, there's a huge moment of transition. Having given a repeated expression to the grimness and the direness of his situation, Christ suddenly cries in the second half of verse 21, "You have rescued me. You have rescued me from the horns of the wild ox." How is that actually fulfilled? In what sense is the suffering Christ rescued? Well, in his resurrection and the events associated with his resurrection, ascension into heaven and enthronement at God's right hand. And the final third of Psalm 22 then relates to that whole phase, to the era of the resurrected, ascended, enthroned Christ. The era when, in the language of verse 27, all the ends of the earth remember and turn to the Lord, all the families of the nations worship before him. And it's in the context of that era that we also have verse 22 of the psalm, where Christ says to the Father, "I will tell of your name to my brothers. In the midst of the congregation, I will praise you." It must be a reference to what happens in Christian worship gatherings, and the stupendous truth that in Christian worship gatherings, Christ himself is present. and highly involved in its different components. He's the presenter leading the sung praise. He's the preacher declaring God's name. It's a mind-blowing verse, is Psalm 22, verse 22. And here in Hebrews 2:12, then, the writer quotes it. Now, later on in the letter, he will express concern about how some of his readers are neglecting the worship gatherings. And he could use Psalm 22, verse 22 here to make a point about that. Look, guys, do you realize what it is that you're staying away from? It's this supernatural meeting between Christ and his people. That's what worship gatherings are. That's what you guys are excluding yourselves from. And I expect that is somewhere in the back of his mind as he quotes the verse. And he does want his readers to start to join up those dots, I should think. But that's not his main point here. His main point here in chapter 2 is the sheer fact that in his words to the Father about our worship gatherings, Christ calls his people my brothers. It's that specifically that he wants his readers to appreciate. There's a guy I used to know at running club who lived in Wideopen, but he would never acknowledge that Wideopen was where he lived. He would always call the area North Gloucester. He obviously thought that that sounded an awful lot better. Now, he and everyone else knew that it was Wideopen. Sometimes, indeed, our runs would take us past his house, and before we got to his house, we would pass a sign saying, "Welcome to Wideopen," which everyone would point out to him with great glee. But he wouldn't budge. The area is North Gosforth, he would insist. There's a difference between knowing something's true on the one hand and openly acknowledging it on the other. Now, in the first part of verse 11, the writer is saying that as a result of God's adoption, Christ and we are the same family. We're in the same family. We're siblings. He's our brother. That is an objective reality. But just because it's an objective reality doesn't mean Christ is going to be inclined to openly acknowledge it. I mean, why would he be? If living in Wideopen isn't something to shout about, then having us guys as your brothers certainly isn't something to shout about, at least not if you're that grand person described in Hebrews chapter 1. But the last part of verse 11 is saying Christ does openly acknowledge it. He's not at all ashamed, the writer says. And verse 12 is the biblical evidence. When speaking to his Father about his people and about their worship gatherings, Christ doesn't refer to his people contemptuously and mockingly or in some highly aloof and offhand manner. No, he says, "Father, those guys whose worship gatherings I want to go to and be part of, those guys are my brothers." He's exuberant about the facts. He's a proud brother. And if you're thinking this morning, well, he might be exuberant about sorted Christians and successful Christians being his siblings, but he won't be exuberant about having me in his family. If you're thinking that, I want to take you for a second to another text. It's in John chapter 20. It's that encounter in the garden where Jesus' tomb is, Jesus' now empty tomb. It's that encounter there between Jesus and Mary Magdalene. And you remember how Jesus speaks to her and he wants her to take a message to the 12. Now think about that. He wants her to take a message to the 12. Who are the 12? Well, it's Peter, James, and John, those men who had fallen asleep when Jesus needed them most to be praying for him and with him. Those men who just couldn't keep their eyes open in Gethsemane. It's those men who had stupidly pulled out their swords when the mob had turned up to arrest Jesus and made a fool of themselves in that way, again at the hour of Jesus' greatest need. It's those men who had fled as soon as Jesus had actually been arrested. They hadn't stuck with him. They just legged it. They'd gotten as far away from that place as they possibly could. It's Peter, who actually hadn't fled, but had gotten himself into an even worse pickle by following Jesus and ending up in that high priest's courtyard where he'd denied 3 times that he had any connection with Jesus. It's Thomas, who is, we find out later, in a place where he's a million miles away from being able to believe Jesus could possibly have risen from the dead. That's the 12. That's the men that we're talking about, that Jesus is talking about, when he wants Mary to take a message to them. So what does he say to Mary then? Go and tell those losers that I'm this close to disowning them for good. Is that his message? No. Go to my brothers, verse 17. Go to my brothers and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and to your Father. So he calls them brothers. Not sorted Christians here we're talking about. Not successful Christians. Not Christians who are on the mountaintop. Not Christians who in the past few hours have put in a dazzling performance. We're talking about Christians who are in the valley bottom. Christians who have messed up big time over the last few hours. And Jesus openly calls them my brothers. And that language of my Father and your Father, it's so beautiful, isn't it? He's not being all possessive here. My Father and your Master. Your God, your Creator. No, my Father and your Father. You think of the famous parable in Luke 15, the parable of the lost son. And you remember how the son goes off into that far country and lives so wildly. And then eventually he comes back. And he comes back wondering whether he's going to be accepted in the father's house, thinking at best he might be accepted as a servant. But you remember how the father runs to him and throws himself on him and welcomes him like a VIP. But then you remember there's that other character that emerges at the end of the parable, the elder brother. And you remember how cross the elder brother is, that this son, who's brought such shame on the family, should be treated so lavishly and so liberally. And here then are these 12 on this Sunday in John 20. Here are these 12 men. And they've wandered into a far country. They've messed up. And they're perhaps wondering, is there any way back to the Father's house for us? And here, this elder brother is the opposite, isn't he, from the elder brother in the parable? This elder brother doesn't argue with the Father. He can't have them back. This elder brother is himself going out to the returning sons and saying, you must come in. You must come in. He's not only my Father, he's your Father as well. That's the kind of elder brother that we have in Jesus Christ, the absolute antithesis of the elder brother in the parable. And that's what he's like toward you this morning. If you're a believer, however much of a mess you feel you are making of things, this morning he's not bad-mouthing you to the angels. And to his heavenly Father, he's shouting about you. He's making much of the connection. He's claiming you as his sibling. Going back to Jeremy and Tim Vine, I read an interview with one of them, and it was Jeremy talking about a few years ago when Tim won an award at the Edinburgh Festival for the best joke at the whole festival. And apparently Evan Davis on Radio 4 had been commenting in the Today programme about this and saying, how on earth did he win the award for this joke? It's a rubbish joke. And Jeremy Vine was listening to this on the radio, and he said, I felt like getting the radio and throwing it out of the window. That's my brother he's talking about. A proud brother. That's what Christ is like. That's what Christ is like toward us. When he hears us being bad-mouthed by others, He wants to throw the radio out of the window. Not ashamed. A brother who says to his father, "Those are mine. Those are mine." A proper brother, a proud brother. Thirdly and finally this morning, a pioneering brother. A pioneering brother. And here I want to go then to a different text altogether as we close, to Romans 8 and verse 29. Romans 8, 29, where Paul writes, "Those whom God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son, in order that he might be the firstborn among many brothers." A few days ago, my oldest brother celebrated his silver wedding. On that day in 1996, he was the first in the family to get married. A few years later, when his daughter Johanna was born, he was the first in the family to have a child of his own. It doesn't always work like that, of course, but it often does, doesn't it? The firstborn in the family experiencing these kinds of things before the younger siblings. And that's the picture that we have here in Romans 8, 29. Now, we mustn't lift the verse out of its context. It goes with the passage as a whole, and especially with verse 17. Look in verse 17, Paul writes that if we're children, then heirs, heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. And so you can see there, can't you, this idea of us believers following in the path set by Christ. He suffered, we suffer. He has been glorified, we shall be glorified. And it's that glorification then that is in view here in verse 29. The verse refers to Christ's image, the image of God's Son. What is this image that Paul is talking about? Well, it's Christ's glorified resurrection body. That's what's in view in verse 29. Paul is talking about Christ's glorified resurrection body. And he has experienced that already then. He has it now. He's in that state of existence now. He has already gone ahead as the firstborn pioneering brother, but the siblings will all follow and be conformed to that image themselves. That's what Paul is saying. As I fulfilled the role of an usher on that bitterly cold day in December in Glasgow at Duncan's wedding, a spotty teenager, the idea of me walking down the aisle several years later seemed a world away, and yet 5 years later I followed my elder brother. As we went to visit my new niece Johanna, and I held this baby, my arms aching because I was so tense and clueless about how to hold a baby, the idea of me holding my own child seemed a world away, and yet 3 years later I followed my elder brother and did that. And this morning then, the idea of that crumbling body of yours being made glorious and being made beautiful and being made indestructible, that may seem a world away. It may seem utterly ludicrous, a crazy prospect from your vantage point this morning. But the day will come when you will follow your elder brother, and what has already happened to him will also happen to you. And so take heart, believer. Amidst weakness, amidst a body that has been pulled magnetically toward the grave, a body that is dying every day, amidst those realities, take heart. You will follow the firstborn. The pioneering brother has gone ahead. He has a risen, glorified body this very moment. And that's your future. That's your destiny. Take heart. Amen.